Welcome back to WordBalloon.com, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Who's the manliest man in comics? If it isn't Beau Smith, he better be in your top five list. The former tough man fighter has written great adventure stories in comic books for years, like The Black Terror for Eclipse, Guy Gardner Warrior, Catwoman, and a series of Wildcat stories with his friend Chuck Dixon. Beau is a B-movie fanatic who gives recommended critiques in his Busted Knuckles column at Silver Bullet Comics. He's also worked behind the scenes as an executive at Todd McFarlane Productions, IDW, and Eclipse. In May, IDW will publish a new two-fisted series from Beau called Cobb, with art chores handled by the great Eduardo Barreto. Our conversation begins with a look at Beau's early years.
We'll start at your beginning. 1985 at Eclipse Comics, that was your first comics gig?
Yep, the very first professional, actually, the very first professional work I ever had was, and of all people, the very first professional writing check that I ever got from a publisher was from Gary Groth.
Okay.
At you know, he headed up the Comics Journal, Fantagraphics, or anything. I had done a series of articles for Amazing Heroes called Letter Hacks Turned Pro.
Okay.
Which I'd done research on and found every letter hack that was a fan, you know, as a kid who ended up, who had letters printed that ended up being, you know, in the writing end, the business end, the art end, everybody, you know, there was Marv Wolfman, Jerry Conway, Roy Thomas, I mean, and even up to Frank Miller, who had a letter printed in the Cat Marvel, a 3 or 4 issue series that Marvel did in the 70s. So, I mean, I had listed everybody. So that was actually my first professional writing work. And in 85, I did the backup one-page gag strip called Beau LeDuc's Tips for Real Men that was in the back of Scout.
And that was, I read in one of your articles you described it as a combination of John Wayne and your dad, Beau LeDuc.
Yeah, pretty much. He kind of looked like me but had the attitudes of my dad and John Wayne. And to be honest with you, the Beau LeDuc character always kind of encompassed things that were always perceived and actually are, you could call them manly, but I like to call it, you know, just doing the right thing. And that's what Beau LeDuc always was, even though he looked like me and was acted like John Wayne and my dad. It was that kind of thing that we just wanted to get across. So Tim Truman, you know, good friend and a fellow West Virginian, always used to tell me, "But Beau, you know, he's kind of a character. We need to stick you in Scout. Let's come up with something." So Beau LeDuc was the end result of that.
That's really cool. And you really came from a group of guys. You mentioned Tim, Chuck Dixon as well. Talk about some of those other guys that were all turning pro around the same time.
Well, there were, and it's usually, at least it used to be, the way that it happened in comics. There were a group of us and from very diverse backgrounds and areas that all broke in together. And for whatever reason, John, we all seemed to, it was like a John Ford stock company or something like that.
That's cool. We all seemed
to fall in together and find each other. In a real Sam Peckinpah kind of way. There was Chuck Dixon, Tim Truman, Flynn Henry, who did work for everybody from Marvel, DC, and everyone else. Tim Harkins, mm-hmm. Tom Lyle, Graham Nolan, Gary Kwapitz, quite a few others. Tim Bradstreet was another one.
Oh, that's great. I know Tim.
There were quite a few more that, you know, those are just the ones right off the top of my head that I can mention. But we were a very tight-knit group, family of creators.
That's really cool.
Go to these conventions, there'd be, and John Snyder was another one, there'd be 8 to 9 of us all sharing a room, you know, having a good time, and it was really a great time. It had all the camaraderie of any sports that I've ever played and stuff. It had all the camaraderie of a team, and we did a lot of stuff together.
I know you've had a chance to collaborate with Tim and with Chuck. How about the other guys as well?
Oh, well, Tim Harkins was actually, Tim, of all of us in that group, Tim Harkins is probably the most talented in the fact that he was a writer, cartoonist, letterer. I mean, he's an inker, artist. There's nothing he couldn't and didn't do.
Okay.
When I worked for Todd McFarlane Productions, he was the artist and co-plotter on Boof and Boof and the Peru's Crew.
Oh, wow, okay.
He's worked animation. He's done Simpsons. He's done everything else. He is actually the artist that was on Beau LeDuc's Tips for Real Men.
Oh, okay.
He penciled, inked, and lettered it. and he lettered for Marvel in DC and every other major company for many years. And again, as well as did coloring books for all the major coloring book publishers and stuff. He actually, of all of us, is probably the most talented of all.
At Eclipse, you got a chance to work on a classic Golden Age character that was just back in comics in the last couple of years for Wildstorm, one of the Nader characters, the Black Terror.
Right.
And you did that series for Eclipse. How much of it was there in your series that, that harkened back to that Golden Age character? And, you know, also, it seems like that would be a character that was enough of a blank slate where you could add stuff. What do you think you added to the Black Terror?
Well, to be very honest with you, the Black Terror was one of the comic books that my dad actually had a few left from, you know, when he was a kid. And I think we found them down my grandmother's house, and he gave to me when I was little. And I was just, I mean, you know, you're a little kid, you see skull and crossbones on a black costume. And it's, you know, and granted, back in the day, his powers varied from issue to issue. Sometimes he could, you know, be bulletproof, and other times he just had, you know, he was just a good fighter. So
sure.
it went here and there. But that left a lasting impression on me, and I always swore if I ever got into comics, I was going to do that character. Well, it was pretty much public domain by 1988, 89 when we first did that, and I'd come up with an alternate universe where basically everything the Capones were, they were actually the Kennedys of this alternate time, you know, and universe.
Okay.
The Kennedys were the Capones, so I did the switch there. And it's something that, you know, I definitely wanted to do. To be honest with you, I did not pull anything, just the basic costume design, not the name or anything else, because he was really Bob Benton. From the old stuff, because we knew we had to do a clean slate, because this wasn't going to be, this was actually, the Black Terror that, that Chuck and I did was, a, you know, a crime thriller. It wasn't superhero stuff other than he wore a costume.
I got you.
But, you know, I came up with that idea, and I was talking to Chuck about it on the phone. He's going, oh, you know, he was throwing these ideas. I said, well, won't we write this together then? Because he really liked the concept. So we, you know, pitched it at Eclipse, where both of us were working anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, yeah, you know, you need to find an artist for this. And Dean Mullaney, the publisher, was pretty stoked about it. And he goes, I tell you what, let's do this, you know, because he liked the whole crime thing of it. He goes, let's do this as a prestige series, do three issues, and really do this upright. And he goes, as far as an artist, I think we ought to look for somebody that, you know, can paint. Because we really wanted to go full throttle on it. So Dan Brereton had just gotten out of art school at the time.
Wow.
And it said submissions in and this, that, and the other. So we, you know, hooked him up with it. And, I mean, he was just a kid.
Okay.
So it just, he did some paintings and some preliminary stuff after what Chuck and I told him how we wanted things to look. And he used a lot of photo reference like our other buddy Tim Bradstreet. So he nailed it. And we went with it. And to be honest with you, you know, I'm not much one that brags unnecessarily, but I sincerely believe that book was way ahead of its time then, and if it were possible and reprinted today, it would stand up without a problem, without any kind of dating whatsoever.
Does Todd then own that, because didn't he win in an auction all of the Eclipse inventory?
Yeah, you know, that's all, you know, as everyone in the press has found out, that was all murky waters.
Okay.
I worked at Eclipse and went to work for Todd as well. In fact, I actually worked for Todd when I was still at Eclipse. And to this day, that whole auction and the bankruptcy is still murky waters. The way that it broke down was, yeah, Todd can do Airboy, the Black Terror, this, that, the other, all that kind of stuff. The only thing is, the way, if I remember, and I've looked at my contract not too long ago, he can't do the characters that Chuck and I did without either us doing them or our permission, because those rights were ours. He can do any kind of Black Terry he wants to. It's kind of like his Miracle Man. You know, that's still a Muddy Waters as well.
You
know, he can do what he wants. It may not be the same one that Neil did, but, you know, I think he can do some form of it. I'm not positive. But that's a whole other show and story there. But so Todd, yeah, Todd can do a Black Terror, Airboy, whatever he wants. You know, that's not a problem. In fact, when I went to work for Todd, one of the first books we were going to do was the Black Terror. We did the first issue. I wrote it. Clayton Crane did the art.
Wow.
Bought, paid for, done. In fact, it's up on my website. And then Todd said, no, let's I just want to keep things, you know, with the horror stuff. So that's when he released Cygore, Curse of Spawn, and those books instead. And Black Terror just got put on the shelf and never seemed to make it out because by that time, Todd's interests were shifted more over towards the toy company. It was becoming bigger,
sure,
and bigger and bigger. And you didn't have that much time to focus on the comics. You could, you know, basically just want to do the Spawn comic and that's it. So it just kind of got put on the shelf.
Okay. Did you read what Alan Moore and those guys at Wildstorm did with the Terror?
I've read some of, yeah, it's, and it's all the other characters, too, the
yeah,
other fighting Yankee and all that. And I enjoy them. I love the artwork on stuff. It's a little out there, which is sometimes Alan Moore's thing, and I'm not. When it comes to Alan and Neil, two of the nicest, most polite guys I've ever known and worked with and stuff at Eclipse. But the, you know, the, generally the stuff they do is just not my cup of tea, as they say,
okay,
my mug of beer. And, you know, so it's nice.
Yeah, really, nothing's
there,
your cup of tea, man.
Much out there for me. I'm more meat and potatoes.
No, I respect that.
But I like their stuff. It's a lot, let's put it this way, I read and favor that a lot more than I do most of the Vertigo stuff, which I just, you know, don't understand. I just shake my head and say, boy, you are a dumb stump jumper.
Well, let's talk about some more of your meat and potatoes stuff. Some of your DC work, man, and I know you co-wrote a lot of it with Chuck. The Wildcat miniseries that you guys did with Catwoman and Batman, those were great. They appealed to me because I'm a sports radio guy by day, and boxing has been my beat for a long time. And I think Wildcat, Ted Grant, is really a great underrated hero in the modern age, and it seems like very few people know what to do with them. I think you and Chuck are the exceptions to that, though, when it came to those two miniseries.
Well, you know, I got to agree. I mean, there's been 70s and 80s, especially the 80s, they at the time didn't know what they were doing with him. I mean, remember they had him crippled, they had him retired.
Yes.
They put a woman in his play. They just, you know, you could tell they were looking for something, they just didn't know what it was. And I think a lot of it was, at the time, they probably didn't have any creators that really wanted to get behind a second-tier character. I don't mean that derogatory term. I mean that just as it
sure
is. You know, everyone was wanting to do Batman or Superman
yeah
at that time. But Wildcat's another character that was some of the comics that my dad had given me that he had read as a kid, and that was another one that was on my hit list to do. And Fisticuffs have always been that and Guns have always been a part of my family going way back, it seems. So it was a natural kind of thing. And Chuck, you know, there you go. Nice, level-headed Chuck, but the heart of a torturer. If you read the Batman Wildcat, which you did, and especially the Catwoman Wildcat, those were some of the, and especially the Catwoman Wildcat was one of the bloodiest, most violent comics to ever get past DC's Comics Code radar. I mean, Chuck and I go, we were writing that going, this ain't going to fly. This ain't going to slide by them. But somehow, Eddie Berganza, who was their editor on it, slid it by.
That's
and
cool.
When people look back at that, they're, you know, I mean, they're, this is a slaughterhouse.
Absolutely.
And we got to do that. And plus, there was also what we like to think there was a lot of romance, a lot of flirtation, and, you know, what I'd call the right bit of wit and humor to it. So we really, with the Catwoman Wildcat, we really hit stride and came out with everything we ever wanted to do, which the next series in that was supposed to have been Robin and Wildcat. And, you know, at the time it just, whatever, this, that, and the other, just didn't happen. I think there were some switches. But we were basically going to have Robin and Wildcat team up, with Wildcat being basically what you'd call, and there's one in every family, the bad uncle. The uncle that slips you a beer at the family reunion, you know, okay, let's go get a sandwich. Okay, let's go down to Joe's bar. You know, a 15-year-old kid, you know, hanging out with the bad uncle. So that's what the way we were going to play that as well. But and who knows, that may happen one day.
That's cool. You know, and as a kid in the early 70s, reading Brave and Bold, those Batman and Wildcat team-ups always did stand out, and I was glad to see the relationship, you know, relinked again with your guys' stories.
Oh, that guy, and Jim Aparo's art
on
those issues were just, he was the guy.
Absolutely.
I mean, he was one of my, to be honest with you, he's one of my favorite Wildcat artists of all time. When I think of Wildcat in my head, you know, other than Sergio Cariello, who did ours,
mm-hmm,
but I immediately always think of Jim Aparo.
That's cool. That's really cool.
We did those. That was Chuck and I really enjoy working together, especially when we, you know, get in sync on a certain thing like that. And it was, you know, Chuck was doing Guy Gardner before I took over. And when he, basically what happened is DC fired Joe Staton off the book who was working with Chuck. And that was the whole reason Chuck took that book. And when they fired Joe and didn't tell Chuck, well, Chuck says, you know, I'm leaving, you know, that's it for me.
Sure.
And they're going, well, you know, we got to find somebody else to take over. And he goes, I suggest, you know, Bo Smith. And I'd worked with Kevin Dooley and Eddie Braganza before. And they, oh, yeah, let's do that. So that's how that segued into me doing Guy Gardner Warrior, starting with issue 20.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask about that. That's cool. So you took over for Chuck on that. Before we get into your work on Guy, I'm curious, how many other projects? You had the Catwoman Wildcat and Batman Wildcat, and you had the Terror. What other books did you co-write with Chuck?
I think that was it. That was okay. Pretty much what we've worked on together. You know, it's just like, you know, anything else when we talk, you know, which is usually once a week or whatever. You know, oh, we need to do something else, and just the right project hadn't come up yet, but I'm sure that will happen again.
Now, with Warrior, it's so funny. That was kind of an odd duck book, and I always wondered whose idea it was to take the Green Lantern and make him a warrior like this.
Well, at the time, and again, this is 10 years ago, when DC was changing Hal Jordan completely.
Right.
And they basically told me, you know, we want to deconstruct the Green Lantern Corps and Green Lantern, and that's going to be a part of your job with doing Guy Gardner Warrior, where you are either killing off or completely changing everybody. So, you know, no more Ring, this, that, and the other. So we've spent probably issue 20 and 21. Guy was in the armored suit there, and that was just a real temporary thing till we all could figure out what we wanted to do. Well, I was all for it, you know, and as a kid growing up, you know, I read Green Lantern, but him and the Flash were always, you know, I bought those when there was nothing else because they were more science related, and, you know, they had a ring. I was the guy, I'd rather see somebody just, you know, get the snot beat out of them than, you know, oh, here's a magic green hammer, you know, that kind of thing. So, again, personal taste. But Mitch Bird, who I'd wanted to work with for a long, long time because I'd seen his work on Cat and Mouse that he did for Silverline Comics back in the 80s. He just has this unique look that's his own. So I was thrilled that I was working with Mitch. So Mitch and I started talking about what we wanted to do. Our personal taste was not to give Guy any powers at all.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted him just to be this globe-trotting, two-fisted adventurer, and that's when I created Buck Wargo and the Monster Hunters. That was going to be his support group that he just went and took on Bigfoot, Yeti, Loch Ness Monster, any kind of urban or global legend you've ever heard. And we got to do that in issues 22 and 23.
Mm-hmm.
The guy was without powers. He had an eye patch. They were fighting, you know, zombie Hindus. I mean, you know, pit snake people. I mean, all kinds of stuff. And that's actually where we wanted to take it. But DC, he kept saying, huh? You know, sorry for these two issues, but you got to give him superpowers. They're not going to buy anything unless he has powers and a costume. And Mitch and I were going, we think this can work. But, you know, it's their playground, their toys.
Sure.
So we had to come up with powers. And what we wanted to do was make him stronger and actually just make him the most talented fighter, warrior, living right up to the name, in the DC Universe. Well, we came up with the things to where, you know, he used ancient weapons, you know, like a tomahawk, a spear, of ancient warriors, that kind of stuff, when he did use weapons. But mostly he would be using his fists and different fighting styles. But DC goes, we got to have a little more than that. He's got to have a costume. So Mitch came up with this warrior thing where we had these war paint tattoo type things, which, with the readers, they either loved it or they hated it. So, you know, it was in between. So, but they kept telling us we had to have powers. And believe it or not, powers that be, the editors, you know, said, Power Rangers are real big. The kids love, won't you have him morph things? You know, and also Terminator was out at that time. You know, and they had all the morphing, so we kind of grunted. Yeah, okay, we'll do it.
So book by committee kind of.
Yeah, exactly. It was, you know, again, their choice. So we said, yeah, we got to do it. So we'll do it. But we were going to only have it to where he could morph, you know, weapons that the mightiest warriors in the universe had used. Because I didn't want it to be like Green Lantern where, you know, there was a giant hammer and he was having a huge egg beater and, you know, things like that.
Sure.
And so we had it in our book as that. And it went like that for a little while. And believe it or not, the book started catching on. I mean, when I took over, they were talking about, you know, this probably only go three or four issues because sales were low. We're looking to cancel. We were at about 18,000 then.
Okay.
Well, about five, six issues into it, we had it almost up to six. By issue zero, I think we had it up to 60,000, which is a huge jump.
You bet.
Well, everyone started, all the other editors wanted to borrow Guy Gardner then because he was looking hot. The book was selling good. And sure enough, you know, you get him over into another book, other creators, other writers, artists. Sir, all of a sudden he's morphing chainsaws and egg beaters. And, you know, and I just grunt and moan. And it was about that time that Mitch, you know, wasn't real happy with that. He was getting tired of the monthly grind. So, you know, he just says, you know, guys, I'm going to step away from the monthly stuff for a while and go do some different things. So we went through a few issues with changing up ours. And as you probably well know, when you start doing that, you start losing readers because there's no consistency.
You bet.
And sure enough, after a while, eight more issues go down, the sales dropped. We were back, you know, getting down to where we used to be. And Guy Gardner was on the bubble of cancellation. So about issue, they told us about issue 38, I think it was, they said, you know, we're going to have to axe the book, so you got till issue 44. Well, by issue 40, we had it built back up again, and by 44, we were up to like 45,000. So, but they already said they were going to cancel it. So, but I got Mitch to come back for the last issue, and
that's cool.
We threw blood, guts, and snot everywhere, and it ended up in just a real ballbuster of a finale and ending. And we got to actually look at it as, well, if we're going to go out on Guy, we're going to go get out on our own note in the way we want to, and that's just the way it happened.
Man, and you know, you certainly have the right vibe about Guy Gardner, and it seems like if they had gone with your original two-fisted concept, it's a shame because today I think that really would sell because that really is the heart of who he was as a character from the start.
That's the way I always felt. I mean, I got so tired of the one-note joke, Batman punched him, bullheaded jerk that all the frat boys in comics think was, you know, so damn funny. I thought, you know, well, that was one issue, one thing. That was okay. But, you know, the guys at Wizard and everything else just thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And I said, boys, you know, I remember my first time, my first girl, my first beer and all, but you move on. There's more.
Sure.
And a lot of people didn't seem to. And that was one of my goals, was to change him from an unlikable jerk and one-note character to put more layers and dimensions on him. I wanted him to be, you know, a true hero, which is what I tried to explain with, you know, him looking for the warrior waters, why he had been this, that, he had had the ring, he didn't have the ring, he had this, he had that. He's always been searching to be the hero, the warrior that he is. Mm-hmm. And that's when I brought in the Valdarian thing where, you know, it was of an alien DNA, it was set up all these thousands of years for him to do this. But more so than anything, I wanted to change his personality. Because if you get the readers liking the character, doesn't matter what their powers are, supporting cast, anything else. If they like that character, they're putting an emotional investment in it, they're going to come back every month. Not for, I want to see him shoot razors, but what's he going to do? What's going to happen to this guy who feels like a part of my family? He's one of my friends. And I really think we pulled that off with Guy Gardner. He actually did become a conglomerate of, you know, of John, but any kind of real man hero that you've ever done. He was every soldier, every fireman, every policeman that, you know, ever took the job, but right.
I get you.
He was a little rough around the edges, yeah, but I think we all are. And he definitely was not politically correct, but then again, he wasn't a jerk either.
No,
so it didn't matter if you were liberal, if you were conservative, it didn't matter. You always knew that Guy Gardner would back you up.
That's cool, and you're right. I think, you know, he was always at the core a hero, and I think you guys kind of showed the reasons why he was still a hero even without the ring.
That's right. We tried to do. Mitch and I really even with facial expressions and stuff like that, really worked hard to try to get that across. I think we did. It was a good, you know, 2-year run. Part of the other thing that was great about working on Guy Gardner was working with Phil Jimenez. Phil, one of the nicest guys, most talented guys in the business, he got what we were doing with Guy Gardner. When he came on for the big issue 29, All Warriors issue, where we had every hero, every character in the DC universe in that one big issue, we had a field day. I would have 8 to 9 characters in a panel going, oh, gee, Phil, I'd write him a note. I'm sorry, there are so many characters. His family goes, he'd write back, oh, can I have 3 more? You know, so I was going, yeah, go ahead. And it was just a wonderful, beautiful milestone. It's a milestone issue. It really is. It's one of those today where I think when people pick it up in the back issue bin, they see Phil's work and they see all these heroes and all this interaction, because to me, that's what Marvel and DC Comics always should be. You've got all these great, long-standing characters. I want to see them interact with each other. I want to see how they're going to act with, you know, when they're hanging out, when they're talking to each other, when they're in a fight. That's what brings readers back.
No, I agree with that, definitely. Character interaction is, you know, DC had all those, that great burst of creativity in the 70s where they went beyond costumes and they brought things back like, you know, the Shadow, and they really went into the Street and Smith pulp characters, the Avenger for a while, and all the fantasy characters that they came up with, too, Claw, Warlord, people like that. Would you ever want to crack at a regular title of something like that?
Oh, without a doubt. And you brought up a very good point. They did that in the 70s when no one else was doing it, and they had to, because in the 60s, late 60s, Marvel basically kicked their butt with all the soap opera type of stuff, and again, character interaction that they were applying, and DC caught up in the 70s, and they did a great job, which, if you look in the next decade, the 80s, the Independents, which is Pacific, First, Eclipse, Kimiko, they all did the same thing. They brought up different genres, different slants on superheroes and stuff. That was, again, another prime milestone time in the history of comics. And I would love, you know, I always love to get in on something different, genre-wise, or just put a twist on something that people are used to one way, and you do it that way, but you just add that little twist, a little bit of Tabasco sauce, just enough to make it interesting.
That's cool. Now, I want to talk about Cobb, the new project you got coming out for IDW. Edward Barreto is your artist. That sounds like it's right up your alley, a good tough man, two-fisted kind of story.
Well, that's exactly what, you know, I've always loved that kind of stuff, as you know, and Ted Adams, who was then the publisher, you know, he's still one of the founding owners of IDW, had always enjoyed that kind of stuff. And he was at Eclipse heading up our distribution back when we were all there. And that's what he liked about the Black Terror. And we were having lunch at Baltimore Con. And he goes, well, he goes, we need to come up with something. He goes, and we'll say, in quotes, tough guy character that we can do. He goes, you know that stuff so well. I know it. I guess I'd like to see, you know, it come out in a comic book form. Let's do it. Let's, you know, have at it. So he gave me, you know, the time to come up with a character and what I wanted to do, and I pretty much kind of knew that. And so he definitely believed in it and saw it through. Now, Chris Ryle, who is the publisher and editor-in-chief there, same way, Chris, you know, latched onto it immediately. And what I wanted to do is a tough guy character that's not a psychopath. No one killed his family, murdered his parents in front of him. He's not, you know, constipated emotionally like so many of them. And I'll be honest with you, I'll basically say like Batman and the Punisher can be.
Sure.
Now, the Punisher can be done right when he's done right, and there's been a few writers that have done it. And Batman is just, he's so far off the radar here or there, it's so scattershot anymore, you know, that it's a shame. So I wanted to do a tough guy that, again, like I said before, you emotionally have an investment in that you like. He's a likable guy, but he does have this thing. Why is he so good? He's a former Level 1 Secret Service agent, all right, before that. And when we show in the first issue, he's been like this since childhood. He's been hardwired to protect, to do what's right since he was a kid. There's no nobility, nothing like that. It's just in his DNA to protect. And he, if someone asked me who he's based on, I can tell you real quick. I've got two dogs. I've got an Australian cattle dog, Chubb, who's just, you know, miss lovable, love everybody. And I've got Blue, who's an Australian Shepherd. And just like Australian Shepherds, they're hardwired to do their job. His job, since he doesn't have any cattle or sheep to herd, is to protect me and watch over me 24 hours a day. He has a job he's invented for himself. He gets up with me at dawn and doesn't stop till I go to bed. And he sorts everything, has to be in order. He's there to protect me, whether it's a car going down the street or a cat walking 5 feet. He's there. And you can see it in his eyes and his mannerisms. He goes instantly into this instinct. Well, Cobb's the same way. When the, you know, to be honest with you, when the crap hits the fan, when everyone else gets all this adrenaline flowing, gets excited, this and the other, he becomes perfectly calm. And just like an accountant ticket inventory, he goes into his job, he goes into his business, everything is sought out. There's no yelling, there's no screaming. He just does his work. And it's an amazing thing to watch. If you've ever seen a dog, like an Australian Shepherd or one of these other herding type of dogs, when they go into their instinct and do their job, it's an amazing thing to watch. Cobb is the same way. We end the first issue, not without saying too much, with him clicking into that mode. And when that second issue hits, that second issue is balls to the walls, full throttle action. But it's action like, I'm hoping, you've never seen before. You've never seen a character handle action like he does. And every bit of the fighting, the gunfights, everything is based on reality, whether it would be floor fighting, submission moves, mixed martial arts, boxing, the whole, you know, genre and styles of fighting I'm inserting into Cobb. Eduardo and I have worked extremely hard research-wise, not only with Secret Service training, the Russian mob, terrorists, but with all these different fighting styles and gunfighting styles, which we're inserting into Cobb.
That's really cool. And, yeah, you mentioned the Russian mob and the terrorist angle of the story as well. It strikes me, and I'm going to venture a guess, that you were a Mac Bolan Executioner fan.
When I was in high school, yes, I read...
I see.
Yes, that, and Westerns, it was Edge and Fargo and Lasseter. Those were,
sure.
And the Mac Bolan the Destroyer, all the, those were the, if, when you were in high school, that's what you read. If you were a guy,
yep.
And I mean a guy, you read that stuff. I wasn't reading The Hobbit. Those are the guys I went to school with were trying to get me into that stuff. I said, no, this is the real stuff.
Well, you know, and that's what I wonder about, Bo, because obviously you've lived the life, and I want to talk about your tough man days in a couple seconds, but that's the thing. Do tough guys read anymore? Because those books were made for, you know, an era when everybody read.
Yep.
And now fewer people are reading, including tough guys and stuff, so it's a shame, and I've always been a fan of stuff like that as well, and artists like Eduardo and Paul Gillespie that know what they're doing to kind of convey that kind of look in a comic book as well.
Well, here's the thing. I think that was that you were hit at 100%. That was the time when real guys, let's put a blue-collar guys, read. And they
sure.
Read that stuff. And why else was Louis L'Amour so popular?
Exactly.
I mean, they read that stuff. And Chuck Dixon, God love him, proved that again when they did, him and Gary Kwapitz did Savage Sword of Conan. That wasn't sold to the comic shops in big numbers. On the newsstands, that was sold to people who never even looked at a comic book.
Yep.
They ate that up. And it's that same group of people. They're still out there. They just don't have much that they can read. Louis L'Amour's dead. They all read his stuff.
Yep.
And, you know, there's no real new stuff, but there's nothing out there for them. And Cobb is the kind of thing, if it was in paperback, movie, TV, whatever kind of form, those blue-collar guys are going to have something they're going to want to read. And those moviegoers now that think, when they go to a Tom Cruise Mission Impossible movie, that they're getting real man tough guy stuff, they're going to see something like this and go, this is the way it's really done. And I'm not, this isn't conceit and brag, this is just, I mean, it still boggles my mind to this day that all these people think Top Gun was a manly movie. That was the biggest priss fest I ever saw in my life. I mean, people talk about, you know, Brokeback Mountain being, you know, a brave, gay love story. No, Top Gun was that. You know, so. Yeah, we don't even want to walk down those streets.
So no one should ask you to be their wingman or anything like that.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, gosh. But that's with Cobb, that's what Eduardo and I are looking to do. We are, We want to give you a tough guy that you wouldn't be afraid to invite into your house. But again, when it hits the fan, this is the guy that you want, you know, driving your car.
I hear you, man. That's awesome. Now, I know you're a big B movies fan.
Definitely.
And so, like, I guess while I have you, you know, and by the way, for people who don't know, and I'm sure I said this at the top in our intro, your columns in SilverBulletsComics.com, Busted Knuckles, very funny stuff.
Thank you.
I really enjoy it. And also, you know, you're catering to the other end of what comic fans are doing, you know, when they're not reading comics and stuff, by mentioning things like B-movies. So I should ask, I mean, has there been anything lately that's been a good rental that probably didn't make it onto the big screens?
Well, yeah, there's a couple right off the bat that I can recommend without any hesitation. And one of them comes from an actor that has done his share of A-list movies, but really has done a lot of B-movies, and it's his first throw at directing. And it was called The Defender, and it's Dolph Lundgren.
Okay.
And believe it or not, Jerry Springer plays the president. Now, I'm no Jerry Springer fan, never have been, but they did the right thing. Yes, they want to, marketing-wise, bring his people in, you know, to rent and watch this movie, but they did the smart thing. He has a very low-profile role in this as the president. He's not on the screen all that long, and it's just in chunks. He's not a deterrent or distraction to the movie. Nothing like he is on TV and stuff. So
I get you.
Saying that, he's in it. But this is an amazing movie in the fact that Dolph Lundgren's first directing, and you go into the movie, the first 5 minutes, then the action starts, and it never stops. They pull off a very complicated storyline and plot, all the while the action is moving constantly. Not a lot. There's a lot of European directors and Asian directors that can do this, but there's not a lot of American directors that can and have done this. Now, granted, if you really wanted to break it down, Dolph was born in Switzerland, so he's not really, he is an American now, but he, you know, wasn't born here. But it's an amazing movie to watch in the fact that even though it's, in quotes, low budget, they used everything as far as location, costumes, guns, this, that, and the other. Everything looks A-list primetime movie because they made the most out of what little they had.
That's
I highly recommend this movie far and above and beyond a lot of stuff that's playing, you know, at the theaters right now. So that's The Defender.
Cool.
With Dolph Lundgren.
Very cool.
An amazing movie. Now, you want some good cheesy fun, Dark Breed, and Jack Scalia is the lead. You've seen him in a million TV movies. You know, he's always played cops and tough guys and those sort of things. And Jonathan Banks, who was the main bad guy in the first Beverly Hills Cop, he was the thug of the main bad guy.
I know who you're talking. The guy who used to be the handler on Wise Guy.
Right, exactly. Same guy. You know, great character actor. Well, he's in it. This is an amazing aliens invade, but they take over the human body kind of thing. So, it's, you know, there's not a lot of alien special effects looking things. But this is a great two-fisted, cheap B-movie. A lot of good lines, a lot of gunplay, and a lot of actually some innovative fight scenes in it for Jack Scalia, who's not known as a martial arts thing. It's just good fist fights and gun things. So that's your high-class B. This is your... And then one movie that I always recommend for everybody to check out, well, actually two, and they were both done, written by Kevin Bernhard, who I co-wrote Primate with at Image Comics with. He has done probably 15 to 20 movies. He's been an actor forever, and now just does the screenwriting and stuff. But he did a movie called The Immortals, which Eric Roberts, Tia Carrera, Chris Rock, William Forsythe, great cast, Clarence Williams III, Kevin is in it as one of the characters. A very smart written movie, heist movie that it's one of those you're going, why isn't this in the theaters? So it's called The Immortals. Kevin wrote it. He stars in it as one of the characters. Then he did another one called Top of the World, another heist movie, which, again, amazingly smart. Tia Carrera, Peter Weller, Peter Coyote, Dennis Hopper, an all-star cast in it, Martin Cove, Kerry Tagawa. Great. Those are two movies I highly recommend. Now, they came out 2 years after the Pulp Fiction craze, and so they've got a little bit of that flavor to them. Mm-hmm. And also, Ely Samaha, who was the guy that produced all these, is he was also married to Tia Carrere at the time. He's also was the producer and head guy on 3,000 Miles to Graceland.
Okay.
So it's that kind of, they're those kind of movies. If you like that, you will love these.
That's
so
cool.
Those are my recommendations on B-movies. I search the web, everything, every day, always looking for new ones. People are always suggesting them. I always check them out. That's a definite passion with me.
That's cool. And, yeah, that's a hallmark of your columns, too, and I appreciate that because I think that's... That's the kind of information that people need, because there's a lot of crap out there that you got to sift through to get to the good stuff. So,
oh, yeah. I mean, I use the website Internet Movie Database. Oh, man, I'm on that. I mean, whenever I get bored or got a few minutes, I'm on that researching, you know, new movies to find out. You know, I like this actor, and it's okay. I start looking for what movies he's been in. Same way with the directors and stuff like that. Great way for to find out, you know, good B-movies.
Now, you mentioned that you co-wrote a couple things with your friend.
Kevin Bernhardt.
Yes, and have you had any screenplays produced?
No, I've wrote all over close. It looked like I was going to get to do one for Gary Daniels, a friend of mine that's an actor who's done a lot of martial arts movies, and Cynthia Rothrock is another friend of mine. So I've got screenplays that I did for both of them. You know, it was just there was no financing. You just couldn't get it at the time.
Sure.
Which is one of the tougher parts because, you know, people always read about it. You know, what do you mean Kevin Costner and Tom Hanks can't get this movie financed? You know, it's a tough row to hoe.
Sure.
And so that's happened. So I've got a couple. You know, I've done the video games for Capcom, which are done, again, in screen play format as well.
That's cool. Which games did you do?
I did Maximo and Maximo Army of Zen. Those are two out. Yeah, those have been out for a while now.
Very cool. And let's talk about your tough man days. Now, because being a boxing fan and stuff, I you know, I'm a student of the game, and I go back even to the early days of the 1900s and know that Jack Dempsey started in really what would today be called unlicensed tough man competitions.
Definitely.
Where they were happening. You know, tell people, because if, you know, some people will hear tough man and they'll think of the stuff they saw on Spike TV. Why don't you tell them about the real tough man competitions, the stuff
well,
that you guys
like
are
you
doing?
Well, it used to be, you know, going back, and to be honest with you, still today, which is very illegal, but no, there was, like Dempsey, he did it on the hobo circuit, what they called it, if
yep.
I remember correctly, where, you know, they would stage it in, you know, docks and warehouses, in cattle fields and corrals, wherever. You know, you would, you know, go into town, okay, who's the, you know, the, in quotes, the toughest guy here, the best fighter. They get a lot of people, a lot of side bets, and do that stuff. A lot of boxers through that era did that, especially
yep.
in the South, where a lot of black boxers could not get, you know, the any kind of headlining, you know, major arena or sports stadium type stuff. A lot of that was done in the South, all through the South. And what a lot of people don't also realize is down the Southwest, through Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, this was done, I guess what you'd call cowboy fighting.
Sure.
Because you would have all these ranch hands and cattle drive guys and all these guys that worked on these big ranches. And they would have, just like they had rodeos and stuff, they would have fist fights would be a part of that as well. And we're talking no gloves. We're talking fist fights.
Bare knuckle fighting, yeah.
So this is something that's been around for a long, long time. And I remember in the 70s, you know, it used to be if you paid $50, you know, you were in. That was it. You paid the $50 registration, you fought. And, you know, there weren't gloves then either. And those were actually tough man contests.
Unbelievable.
Literally.
No,
you know, gloves soon came after because they became, you know, literally brawls. There were more brawls in the, which this still goes on today, more brawls in the stands than there would be in the ring sometimes. And you get a lot of guys that box golden gloves and stuff that, you know, after a while, you know, you're done with it. You're not going to turn pro, but what else you got to do? Well, tough man contest, you know, slowly became, you know, evolved into ways of making money and still hitting people. It's like UFC. I mean, that's changed so much. That whole thing, octagon fighting, whatever you want to call it, has changed. When it first started out, it was a freak show. I mean,
sure.
You know, you had a 600-pound guy up against a 200-pound guy this year. And now it has been refined to such an art that, I mean, you know, I'm a big boxing fan and have been, you know, for many years. The whole family's been involved in it. But I'm slowly switching over to, you know, the UFC style because there is not all the corruption. There's not all the criminal element that has slowed and basically soiled boxing so
much. Certainly.
You can't get anything done. You can't get decent matches. You can't get guys that will fight every month.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I think I was going to ask you about comparing that to what's going on with boxing today. And I agree with you, too, Bo. I think I was a guy, too, being such a hardcore boxing fan, that Ultimate Fighting really did kind of creep me out because it was so weird. And like you say, there were these crazy mismatches. But now they really have kind of refined it into a real sport. And I have to admit, I have watched a few matches since, and it is entertaining. And oh. there is more skill than I initially gave it credit.
Oh, that's the whole thing. And it's taken to basically 10 years for those skills to be refined to what it is today, because there are set rules, there's this, that, and the other. But when you watch it today, oh, my gosh, you cannot, let's put it this way, you cannot be just a straight brawler. You cannot be just a barroom brawler doing this. No, you have to be a smart guy
yep.
to do this stuff now. And these guys are in incredible shape and so skilled. I mean, a lot of people that are watching for the first time, they're seeing these two guys on the mat, and it doesn't look like they're doing them. And all of a sudden, this one guy's tapping because he's getting the snot choked out of him. You the camera angle's right, you can see it. There's such intricate ways to this. Mm-hmm. And that's what amazes me. Every time I watch it, I learn something new. And it's just fascinating.
Let's talk about what else is coming up. Now, you mentioned, as we were prepping for the interview, a story that had been greenlit but then was shelved, an interesting crossover, Wonder Woman and Xena?
2000, DC Comics, Eddie Braganza and Maureen McTeague got a hold of me, wanted to do, see if I was interested in doing Wonder Woman versus Xena. Because both of them had known I've always wanted to write Wonder Woman. I've always felt that was a character that, again, like Guy Gardner, the core is there, but it just she needed a little bit extra, to be the icon that she truly is. And I said, yeah, I'd like to do it. I said, but I don't want to do one of these big galactic or supernatural fights where it's just, a lot of screaming and a lot of yelling and this, that, and the other. I said, if I do it, I want to do it like the Xena episodes that are the lighthearted ones. And if you ever watched the show, do you remember a couple?
Sure. Oh, absolutely.
I loved those. I thought, now this is fun. They've got action. They've got a sense of humor. And not a stupid one, but a witty sense of humor. So I said, I want to do that. And they go, well, yes, give us a proposal on it. So I did. They loved it. They read the script. And to be honest with you, and I'm not bragging or anything, it was the funniest thing they ever read. And especially with Wonder Woman and Xena, they really, really enjoyed it. Now, I got to say, it's one of my favorite things. I gave it to Gail Simone not too long ago. She was asked about it, so I sent it to her. And she wrote, you should be writing monthly books for DC. This is hilarious. This is, too funny. And, that meant a lot to me because Gail is like Chuck and I's sister.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
She loves the same things we do. She writes and I'm not saying she writes like us, but she writes the kind of stuff Chuck and I both enjoy. She cares about the characters.
I hear you.
And, that meant a lot to me. Coming from her on that. So recently Dynamic Forces has gotten the rights to the Xena comic book. So
okay.
I approached Nick Barucci the other day about it, and he goes, I'm all for it. Get DC to do it. I'm in for it. And at the time with 2000, Eduardo and I were supposed to do this. In fact, I did the script, got paid for it. Eduardo did first 10 or 15 pages. Then this is a crossover with Dark Horse, who was doing Xena at the time.
Okay.
Well, the Xena TV show got canceled at that point. Dan DiDio was coming on just then at DC, and I think he was just looking at everything as an overhaul, which he had to look at everything. You come in like that, you got to change. They expect changes, and they want to see some stuff, done.
Sure.
And so that was one of them that I guess he thought was on the bubble of, well, the show's not on anymore, and Dark Horse is soon not going to be doing the comics, so we're not going to do this. Even though, I sent a couple of letters and memos back saying, really, this is Wonder Woman versus Xena. Both have huge audiences. This will sell in comics, trust me.
It's a natural.
You know, it was a huge corporate decision that they had to make, and I understand that. But now here, a few years later, since Dynamic Forces is bringing back Xena, I think it's a perfect opportunity, and I still believe to this day there's not a fan out there that wouldn't buy an Elseworlds one-shot, which is what this is, 48-page, of Wonder Woman versus Xena. I mean, and Wonder Girl's also in it. It's and also Gabrielle with Xena.
Sure.
And Aries is the bad guy, in quotes, in it.
Now, okay.
I see no reason why this thing would not, you know, sell extremely well.
No, it's a perfect matchup. I think it makes a lot of sense. And hopefully, you know, on the back of things like the Red Sonja Claw collaboration that Dynamic Forces in DC is in the midst of, I hope this happens. I think it's a great idea, man.
Well, I'm going to be doing my part on it as far as a little push and a little shoving and a few phone calls and see what I can't get done here.
And to tie into our previous subject, John Shulian, the creator of Xena, started in Chicago and was the boxing writer for the Sun-Times for a good 10 years.
Are you serious?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's excellent news. I never knew that. Well, I tell you, when I was doing Batman Wildcat and Catwoman Wildcat at D.C., I called Ring Magazine, and Nigel Collins.
Yeah, absolutely. I know Nigel.
Was a huge help. Called and gave me a couple emails, this, that, and the other, about we were trying to figure, because Ted Grant's size, we had him, and this is the way he always should. They got him smaller now.
Yeah.
He was always 6'5", 250. So, you know, he was looking to be, basically, he was always George Foreman-ish kind of style.
Absolutely.
You know, as far as size, he was a big guy. The thing I talked to Nigel about, and he was so helpful with, we went back, and he researched a few things, and I went through all my stuff, and we were looking, I wanted Wildcat to have the longest reach of any boxer. So we came up with, I think it was 83 to 84 inch reach.
Oh,
and it was
God.
Because there have been guys that had a reach like that.
That's 7 feet.
It's just about.
Wow.
So that was his, that was, in fact, we even had it in his stats in one of those miniseries, you know, where they give the size, weight, and things.
Sure. Hey, yeah, I remember that.
And that was what we came up with. You know, we wanted to be within the physical realms of reality.
Certainly.
But still at the same time, and that was one of the things. He was very, very helpful on that. I sent him the issues, and he enjoyed them.
That's really cool. No, that's great, man. And like I say, yeah, you know, in fact, I just read the most recent JSA Classified that had a team-up of Flash and Wildcat, and Flash made a comment of when you fought Sugar Ray, and I'm like, oh, no, they didn't make Ted Grant a middleweight, did they?
That's what now I heard. I got a couple of emails. Somebody else mentioned that, and I'm thinking, oh, not again. And somebody else mentioned that he was a middleweight, and I'm going, no, no.
Heavyweight not. Champion of the world, absolutely.
Yeah, and he even was a heavyweight champion, you know, the world. That was his.
And I know for a while they even, like, qualified and said, well, heavyweight champion of New York State, which I'll even accept as a hardcore boxing guy because New York would do that every now and then. There'd be a world champion, and New York would say, yeah, whatever. This is our champion.
Yeah.
So, but that's, I think Ted Grant needs to be a heavyweight.
Oh, without a doubt. I tried to establish that in a couple of the showcase one-shots that I did of Wildcat as well, that I did by myself, and where I actually had to redo his origin a little bit. I kept pretty straight to what it was, but no, he's a heavyweight. That was the whole thing. He doesn't have any powers or anything. 6'5", 250 with an 83-inch reach. That's going to be an imposing person.
You bet.
And without any superpowers, he's going to have to be that. But, you know, now we're getting into, you know, he said, she said.
Yeah, what are you going to do? Well, Bo, I appreciate this, man. This has been great. Is there anything else that we should mention for people looking for your stuff? Obviously, the column at Silver Bullet Comics.
Yep,
and, of course, your website.
Is that Silver Bullet, I think the actual thing is silverbulletcomics.com because there's another one that's actually a store that has almost the same thing, so it's very confusing. All they got to do is get on Google, type in Busted Knuckles,
there you
come
go.
Up.
And the Flying Fist Ranch, of course, your
Flying
own website.
Flying Fist Ranch, yep, that's www.flyingfistranch.com.
Yeah, I'm saying Flying
and
Fish.
And then I do
sorry.
A monthly column called Dot in the Eyes at the Comic Buyer's Guide.
Very cool.
Three different things that they can always get a little fill of Bo and testosterone.
I enjoy doing that every week and enjoy reading your columns, and we'll continue to do so. And really looking forward to Cobb from IDW.
All right, well, thank you very much, John. I appreciate the time.
That'll wrap things up for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. Be sure to check in at wordballoon.com for more information about upcoming interviews. This is John Suntress. Word Balloon is a copyrighted feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2005.